Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the coolest podcast on the planet, Blood, Sweat, and Strife. I'm Mason. My pronouns are she, they.
I'm Isabel. My pronouns are she, her.
And today we have a guest. Her name is Flundering Chipper. She's a YouTuber, an educator, and academic, a vanilla bitch Olympic medalist, and an excellent belcher.
Hi. I'm Chip. Hello. I was smiling because I love that intro so much.
I was like, kicking my feet. At first I was like, is she going to be okay with me calling her an excellent belcher? But like, I ran it by you and you were cool with it and I was very happy.
I absolutely did not give you my permission. This is a lie.
These are lies and slander, Mason. I can't believe.
No.
I can't. In fact, this is it. I'm making a splinter podcast after this. Oh my God.
I'm going to join that
I knew
one.
You were a trot. I have the receipts. I can prove myself in a court of law. I did run it by Flundering Chipper.
I mean, I will say the belch that was in the abortion and ableism video was very impressive.
Oh, thank you so much.
No problem.
This sweet talking podcast panel. Oh my goodness.
At the start of every episode, we begin by asking how you're doing today. So, how are you doing?
I'm okay. I'm juggling back pain, grown-up back pain from sleeping on my back, and having a nice time talking to you folks. So, it's a lot of complicated feelings. It's good and bad. Physical pain, emotional joy. That's where I'm at. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Good. I've been very busy lately, but my work has been very rewarding. Been making YouTube videos, TikToks, that sort of thing.
Mason's been kicking a lot of ass and taking a lot of names when it comes to work lately.
No kidding.
I have been. I came here to eat ass and chew gum, and I'm all out of ass, so I'm going to be chewing some gum.
I have to steal that.
So you are a YouTuber whom I have actually been watching for a pretty long time now, so this is all very surreal for me. So I wanted you to let the audience know what you do on YouTube and what sorts of things your channel generally covers.
Well, I think I'm known as a video game analysis YouTuber. But I like to talk about politics, culture, movies, books. So I talk about whatever's distracting me that week on my YouTube channel. Is that a fair description, do you think?
I think that's a fair description. Yeah? Okay. Like, your videos tend to go wherever you want them to go. But they always make sense. Like, you draw from a lot of different sources. You draw from books, movies, music, all sorts of things. But overall, like, I find in your videos, there's always an overarching, like, point and, like, message to them, which is usually very insightful and helpful.
Oh my God. Thank you so much. It's also...
Like I said, I'm a fan of your work.
I have to say, it's also surreal talking to you, because you were a username in my comment section for so long. I forgot that there was probably a person behind those letters, and now you're a voice. So, really, really cool, super surreal to be talking to you.
Aw. Yeah. That's very flattering. Yeah. Like we've said, you cover a lot of different stuff. Particularly, you're known as a video game analysis YouTuber. And I remember one of the videos that I saw from you that actually really helped me feel better about my own disability. I'm sensitive to light and noise. I have photosensitivity. I also have a lot of general chronic pain. But you did a video on disabilities in gaming. And I wanted you to talk a little bit about why you think accessibility in gaming is so important.
I think on the face of it, obviously it's important to think about accessibility because there are people to whom many video games are inaccessible. And even if, you know, you're somebody who has no trouble accessing pretty much any game they want to play, it's important to think about how other people are deprived of those experiences. At the same time, I think even for able-bodied people, it's probably important to think about accessibility for personal reasons too, because disability touches all of our lives at some point, you know? Many people who are able-bodied now might become disabled later in their lives. We might have a loved one who has a disability. And so I just think that it's never a bad idea to think about on the bare minimum level how our video games that we love might be presenting barriers to certain people. And especially because we want to be able to share these things with each other and presumably continue to enjoy them for the rest of our lives, right? And I think like one of the examples of that is over the pandemic, I feel like subtitles gained a lot of like cultural purchase. People are really into subtitles now in movies and in games. People, I think, who maybe don't have, you know, hearing loss or who don't necessarily need them to process, you know, audio better, just find it's a more pleasant experience sometimes to engage with audio-visual media or audio having like subtitles or a transcript available to them. And so sometimes I just think like accessibility just makes things better even if you don't necessarily need it, right? So yeah, I know that's kind of a long-winded answer, but I think that there's a general social benefit that we could all gain something from thinking about accessibility in games. But specifically, sorry to keep talking, but specifically,
keep going.
Okay,
please.
Great. Oh, that's great. I can talk in a podcast. I think the other thing is that, like, when it comes to game design, there's always an advantage to thinking more deeply about why we're designing something in a certain way. Like, are we designing something to challenge the player's physical prowess, to challenge their reaction time, or to challenge their familiarity with the mechanics? And I think even if you don't come up with, like, an alternative way to design a game, I think that it's really valuable to just think, as a game designer, what is it that I'm actually trying to test the player on here? What is important to me to try to challenge the player on? Does that make sense?
That makes a lot of sense.
That makes total sense. Yeah. Like it's the difference between, am I challenging them strictly through game mechanics, or is the challenge in how they're interacting with the interface that we've set up for them?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like where do we want the challenge to be residing?
It kind of reminds me of how, like, I feel like the philosophy in designing video games has really changed a lot over time, because like back in like the 80s and 90s, you had to make games really fucking hard because there just wasn't that much content there because of the limitations of the systems. So like you go back and play like something like, I don't know, Super Mario 3, and by the end of that game, it's just fucking ridiculous. It's so hard. Your reaction speed is going to get tested. You also might throw your controller at the screen and never play the game again. But, like, over time, like, not only do we have more capacity to design experiences in gaming now that are longer, but we also just have a lot more options. Like, most people I know have, like, hundreds of games in their Steam library. So if a game is getting really frustrating for them, they can always just play a different game that is better and easier on them. So I think, like, over time, like, what game developers are testing in people and how we interface with the games that we play has grown and evolved a lot.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that what players are expecting from an experience is changing. I think people want immersion. I think people want an experience that, like you say, can be stretched out for a longer period of time, that you don't necessarily binge in 2 hours. So yeah, I think that people are having to sit with game mechanics in a different way than they were 30 or 40 years ago. So because the medium has been evolving faster than I think we've been aware of, it's important to step back sometimes and reconsider the fundamentals.
Yeah. Sensibilities evolve alongside of technology,
I think. Yeah, totally.
And I think as well, too, another aspect of this, not necessarily one that we want to drive into here, but I think another aspect of what's been pushing game design and the directions that it's been taking, especially when it comes to AAA titles, is there's a drive to incorporate graphical elements that require very expensive pieces of equipment to be able to use properly. And this financial incentive is a negative force, I think, on game development that we've been seeing get to a really bad point right now at this point in history, where we see video cards getting ridiculously expensive and just, I don't know. I had a deeper thought that I was going with this, but it was just an element that came to mind.
I feel like
that makes sense. Yeah. I've also noticed too, like, this is once again from the perspective of somebody who has a disability and is photosensitive. I've noticed that in a lot of like newer games, even like remakes of old games, like the Spyro games, for example, there's this tendency now for game developers and designers, especially in like bigger titles, to just fill up the screen with as many particle effects and explosions as they possibly can. Mm-hmm. And that gets really like overstimulating for me very quickly. So like, I often feel like my needs just aren't being considered when these video games are being designed. Like, I'm sure it would take a little bit of work, but there should be more accessibility options in gaming. Like, a game like Celeste, for example, is actually really good about this. And I think the fact that they have accessibility settings strengthens the message of that game.
Yeah, and I think Celeste is such a good example of how you don't have to sacrifice difficulty to make something accessible. Like, that game, on so many levels, is designed for so many different people. It's customizable based on what the player needs, but I don't think at any point does it sacrifice its challenge and, you know, the thing about it that makes it so immersive. So, yeah, I think Celeste is a great example.
Yeah, also just, like, the mechanic of, like, dying a bunch of times and trying and trying again. Like, the actual gameplay fits in with the themes of the story. And I think that's just a really cool thing. Something that you've also covered a lot in your videos is storytelling in video games. And I wanted to pick your brain on why you think video games have such a unique capability to engage players and to get them invested in a story.
Oh, this is a tricky question, honestly, because when I try to isolate the thing about video games that's so uniquely engrossing, I always have this little voice in my head that's insisting film or literature or music also have that characteristic. But so I guess, like, there's two things that I think of. And one of them's obvious. I think video games are very interactive. And obviously, all stories are interactive, because even if you're listening to someone telling a story, paying attention to the person telling the story is a kind of interaction, right? Like, the person is expecting you to receive the information and show that you're receiving it. So that's a kind of interaction, listening is. But I think that video games allow players to break down interaction to a very granular level, and those grains are going to look so personal to each player, and that's what is so attractive. It's this, like, personalized specificity. So I could tell a story about Jerry going and punching Gary, but if that story is in a video game, it's like Jerry walks into a room, jumps on a table, does 45 squats, sets everything on the table on fire, and then walks behind Gary and starts a conversation with him. And that, it's like something about that is specific to me and how I engaged with the story, the details that I thought were interesting. So, like, I think that video games make interactivity look a bit different when they tell stories. But Also, and this is a working hypothesis, I don't know how much I'm willing to defend this, but I also think that video games are engrossing and, like, they can tell stories in such particular ways because they engage so many of our senses. Engaging both, like, visual and auditory senses is one obvious way that they do, but you have to get your body involved in some way. Like, there's tactility, I think, with video games, even if it's just you touching your keyboard. And I don't know, I think that that gets sort of overlooked sometimes when we talk about what's so interesting about video game storytelling. It's this feeling that my body is somehow influencing the way that the story is unfolding, like, even if it's just my thumb moving, you know?
That's a really good way of putting it. I think the best example I think the best example that comes to mind of, like, tactility in video games would probably be, like, the one that really pioneered, like, motion controls, and that's the Wii.
Yeah.
Which everybody and their grandmother had at one point in time. And that was a really groundbreaking system because you had the motion controls, you also had, like, the Wii Fit board that you could get if you wanted to play, like, Wii Fit games. And it was this sort of console where you felt like you were connected into the game in a way that other consoles weren't providing you at the time. Like, even something as simple as, like, playing a game of, like, tennis on Wii Sports was a new and exciting experience for, like, a kid like me at the time.
Totally. I think even, like, you know, when your controller vibrates.
Yeah.
Like, not everybody likes haptic feedback, but there's something about that that's there for a reason, right? Like, I think that developers are aware to a certain extent that we like having this sense that our body is influencing something happening in the story, and then we get some sort of tactile response back. But I feel like there's probably a lot of science behind that that I haven't looked into, so that's why I'm not super married to that idea. You know what I mean?
Fair.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, but I definitely think there's an element of immersion that can be, that can come along with that. And some games use that better than others, for sure. Like, I remember the first time playing Metal Gear Solid and having a boss start to manipulate the vibration feedback on a controller. It was impressive the way the immersion level that they managed to achieve just with something so simple as that.
Totally. And I think also, sorry, I'm just thinking about how controllers feel in my hands now. You remember when everybody was addicted to Rock Band and Guitar Hero? Like,
yes.
It's just, there was something about feeling like the instrument in your hand and getting to smash the drum. Something about actually putting force behind what you're doing, right? That made it so engaging.
Yeah, I think that's probably one of the best examples of that, honestly. I don't know anybody who didn't play that game who didn't feel like, to some degree, like that's what they were doing. They were actually belting out a rock song in front of an audience.
Right?
That was actually how I initially learned how to play the drums. Like, I did not have a drum set as a kid because that was very expensive. Except for those little, like, first act kits that sound like shit. But my mom got me a copy of the Beatles Rock Band because I loved the Beatles. And, like, practically every Beatles song uses, like, the same, like, two or three beats in it. So I would just play along to Beatles songs on the drum kit. And then when I switched to an actual drum set, I already had, like, the foundational, like, building blocks of, like, how to be a drummer.
That's so cool.
I think, like, with video games like that, especially when it comes to, like, the Rock Band, like, drum side of things, there's a potential to not only, like, entertain you, but to also, like, teach you something about music.
Totally. Do you still play the drums?
I still consider myself a percussionist. It's what I listen for in my music, but, I guess I'll just, like, explain my disability real quick. When I was 18 years old, I had a really nasty concussion, which affected my nervous system in a number of ways. So all of a sudden, I was dealing with a lot of chronic pain. Mm. If I move around too much, the chronic pain gets worse. So I can't really, like, play a drum set particularly well anymore. Mm. But, like, I still kind of have my chops, and I'll, like, mess around on, like, a practice pad every once in a while. And I'm always listening to the rhythms in music. Like, I will count along to songs in my head, even if the rhythms are, like, syncopated or complicated. Mm. Because I studied it intensely for years, and I just fell in love with it. And when I became disabled, I felt like a piece of my identity was gone. Because, like, not only was I not able to play the drums, but I also was missing out on a form of connection through playing music with my friends. And some of those friends drifted apart from me. Other friends stuck by me, which was cool. But yeah, that's a little bit of backstory about me. And I still consider myself a percussionist and drummer, but I'm a non-practicing percussionist and drummer.
That's beautiful. And I think I'm going to steal that label because Rock Band inspired me to learn how to play guitar. But I have no tenacity, so I quit after 3 years because my teacher told me that I should have had, like, a G minor chord down better than I did. And I was crushed, so I gave up. But maybe I'll call myself a non-practicing strings musician. And then...
Hell yeah.
Yeah, I get to reclaim the label. It's great.
I love it. Yeah, I'm here for it. As a non-practicing trumpeter, I'm here for it.
Oh my god. This is gorgeous.
Yeah. A lot of people have, like, a history with music, even if they don't play particularly much anymore. And I think that, like, having those experiences where you get to make music with other people and practice something consistently, like, you can learn a lot from doing it aside from just, like, the music itself. Totally. Like, there's a lot to be said about, like, the discipline that it takes to practice an instrument every day and, like, the love that you must have for that instrument. So, yeah, just little thoughts on that.
So true.
Yeah. But, yeah, another thing I want to talk about with you is that your videos are very academic, and you've mentioned that you're a teacher as well. You're also somebody who is on the left, and in your videos you're fairly open about that. So I was wondering how your politics inform what you teach people and how you go about teaching.
Well, I should qualify this because I told you in DMs and I'm really worried about seeming like a poser or something, or I don't know, somebody who's making false claims to being a teacher. So between my undergrad and my graduate degree, I had a couple of teaching positions where I would, I would have to plan weekly lessons and lecture a class of undergrads, and obviously I graded all their work, and I've been doing grader marker positions since, like, 2016 or 2017 in various disciplines in business, film studies, general introductory university writing courses, and I've gotten to do some guest lectures on movies I like. It's been great, but I'm allegedly a teacher. That's what I'll say. We can debate that if we need to. As for how I approach being a teacher or teaching people with the politics that I have, that's also a difficult question. I think that critical thinking is the best propaganda, is how I'll start this. I don't approach teaching like I have to convince people to think the way that I do, because I think students can sense that you're trying to push them in a direction, and I think that automatically sort of predisposes them to disliking or disagreeing with your position, or at least being incurious about it, right? So if a student writes something that's misogynistic, the only way that I really allow myself to respond to it is with curiosity. So unless it's vile, you know? So first-year film students like to do this thing where if a mother character is on screen... Business students do this all the time, no matter what. Even if they have no excuse. But if they're writing about a woman, they'll say, mothers have this innate instinct to blah, 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 right? And obviously, the feminist in me wants to just burn the essay because why do I have to read that? But
yeah,
the way that
I didn't know I was reading Schopenhauer right now.
Exactly. Jeez. Yeah. Like, what is this relic from the past that I hate so much? But the way that I respond to it is to ask a question that has an answer, like an obvious answer. So like, where did you get this idea that women are naturally predisposed to XYZ? Or do you have evidence for this claim you're making offhandedly that mothers are naturally predisposed to, you know, want to protect their kids? And usually that stops them from making those claims later, because I think it's people become sensitive. At least you're starting to foster this voice in their head that's saying, oh, I have to actually think about where the information that I'm sharing comes from. So
yes,
that's what I try to encourage, is to get people to stop in their tracks when they're thinking about something and to consider, like, where is this belief I have coming from? And is it actually just a fact of the universe, or did somebody put it in my head, you know? Sometimes it's kind of painful. That's the other thing I'll say about it. Like, there are students in my classroom sometimes who are marginalized, who have to deal with knowing that their peers are apathetic at best to issues that are super, super important to them or painful for them, right? And the way that I have to handle that is to, like, especially in a university classroom, be welcoming to all the students, to make sure, to try to find this really tricky middle ground between protecting the students who are obviously being hurt by what their peers are saying, and also trying to guide the other students into thinking about these things more critically without, you know, putting them on the defense and making them, I guess, angry at me or, like, you know, bitter towards feminism or leftist politics as a whole. So I don't know. I guess, like, generally I try to bear in mind that I was a super different person when I was 19. Like,
same.
Right? Like, God, thank God none of us are the same person we were when we were 19.
Oh my, like, God.
That guy sucked. That guy had so much baggage and so much internalized fucking bigotry. Like, I did not like that guy.
Well, I think you wouldn't have liked me when I was 19. I openly and vocally identified as an anti-feminist.
I was an anti-SJW.
Oh, thank God.
It was bad.
Another survivor from the pipeline.
Now I'm making leftist educational content.
Right?
So, oh, how far I have come.
Oh my gosh. I love that for us. I say this to say that I'm not, you know, I'm not in a place to judge anybody, whether that's for their politics or for, like, their ability to meet a deadline, right? I wasn't always the person I am now. And it was because people believed in me that I was able to get to this point where I can ask people to think more critically, right? So I guess I just approach teaching with the goal of making sure the people I'm teaching know that I believe in them the way that other people believed in me. So.
Yeah, and, like, education is a gradual process. Like, if you can have a positive impact on how a person sees the world, that is such a good thing. Like, I remember I spent a lot of time chatting with my little half-sibling over the past couple of years, just about, like, the world and history and politics, and he's, like, 16 now, so he's old enough to be learning about that stuff, and he's definitely curious about it, and he was watching all these videos about history on YouTube, and I was like, let me just slide in here and give you some, like, class consciousness. So I remember, I found that, like, the best way of approaching these things is to just ask people, like, open-ended questions. I told him once early on in this whole process, I have a lot of, like, videos and books and resources I could direct you to if you want to learn more about, like, where I stand on these issues. And he was like, well, I don't really like consuming stuff that's too far out of, like, what's considered normal. And I was like, okay, so where does normal come from? And then he was like, well, I guess it goes back to the founding of the country. And I was like, okay, so how was the country founded? And then the gears just started turning in his head. And he was like, oh, okay. And then after that, I started showing him, like, you know, like, second thought videos and stuff. And now he's He's basically just a little communist. It's very cool. But yeah, like, obviously, like, we still have, like, things that... It's not like our beliefs are identical. Like, I didn't brainwash the kid or anything like that. But he came to his own conclusions by being presented with information, and I just kind of helped push him along a little bit.
Yeah, and it sounds like you didn't make him feel inadequate or incompetent for not knowing something that you knew.
That's the worst thing that you can do.
Yeah.
Like, as a teacher.
The last thing you would do is destroy your pupils' confidence in themselves. That's all that does. If you call somebody stupid for... Okay, people, like... There's such a huge difference between ignorance and stupidity. And, like, I don't like the word... Like, I'm trying not to use the word stupid anymore, period. And just trying to purge it from my lexicon entirely. In general, doing anything that makes someone question their own intelligence when you're trying to educate them is not useful. This is something I can't relate to anybody else on, really, though, because I've never held a cringe belief in my entire life. I was actually torn directly from the thigh of Marx himself. So, like.
With 100% correct takes. Piping hot, right out the oven.
Yeah.
Right.
100% purity of takes.
Right. Like, from birth, I was literally just like, fuck capitalism. That was, like, my first words.
Yeah.
Oh, so true.
My first words will be...
Mine will probably be that I should have eaten breakfast before I had that third cup of coffee. I won't be able to think about my principles when I'm dying. I'll be just experiencing coffee-induced bowel issues.
Oh, God.
Those are the worst. I saw a post that was so real. It was like, there needs to be more bathrooms in coffee shops. They're selling straight doo-doo juice there.
Literally!
And like, right. Literally.
There needs to be more public bathrooms, period. Like, this is, like, a genuine problem. We don't have enough.
It's a huge problem in big cities.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. There's a whole episode of How To with John Wilson about just finding the bathroom, and there's so much imagery of just people who, like, went on the street because they couldn't find anything.
Yeah, right. And then society has the audacity to make it illegal to poop in the street, and I'm not saying it's for bad reasons, okay? But then why is it not illegal to not always have toilets available for me?
Right.
Hello?
Exactly.
Right. If you're going to let businesses bar people from using toilets that they could otherwise access because they're not a paying customer.
That's right.
Like, if we're going to sit here and say that businesses have no social responsibility to make their facilities available to the general public instead of letting them just shit in the street or forcing them to just shit in the street. If that's going to be legal, then it should be legal to shit in the street. You can't have it both ways.
I love this logic.
This has gone in such an important direction. We started in the classroom, we wound up in the shitter, and that's really the best.
I love this conversation because toilets feature prominently in several of your videos. Like, sometimes you'll just go on a tangent and just, like, stick your foot in a toilet. I'm just like, God damn.
It's good to know people notice that because I'm always, every time I go back to the bathroom, I'm like, is this all for naught? Does no one appreciate this motif?
I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
I think that was a really good, like, chat about, like, the classroom and having to use the bathroom sometimes. Something that I really want to talk to you about, because you have a super fascinating video out about this. It's a movie that a lot of people are probably familiar with, but there's a lot to discuss about it. I want to chat with you about Akira.
Mm-hmm.
Because Akira is just the raddest shit ever, and has so much to say, and it still feels so relevant, and, like, it really captures what it feels like to live through, like, seemingly apocalyptic times.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted you to kind of give, like, your spiel on your interpretation of this movie.
Okay, I'll try to condense it, because, I've had so much distance from that video now that I couldn't rewatch it, because it was giving me the cringies, seeing myself in older versions of my work. So I guess the main thing I'll say to summarize my take on the movie is a lot of people approach the explosions in Akita as like literal callbacks to the atom bomb and and nothing else, which I'm not saying there's no merit to that, but I think that there's a lot of symbolism going on there, and that I think that the like Akita as a film and all of the big booms in it are gesturing to stuff that you don't really see so much as you feel, right? So
yeah,
around the time that the manga was being made and that the film came out, there were huge historical and economic shifts happening. Like, I think, so the emperor was getting real old, and I think the year after the movie came out, so 1989, he passed away. And I don't know if you folks remember what it was like when Queen Elizabeth died, but when a monarch dies, even if you don't like him, it still feels like the society has just exfoliated itself, right? It's a big deal.
Yeah.
Yes.
And then...
Can I very briefly tell you what my idea for Queen Elizabeth's remains are?
Okay, yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so we'll get back to the topic at hand, yeah, like, very shortly. But my idea for Queen Elizabeth's remains is, I think, her body should be dismembered and shipped off to, like, individual parts of her should be shipped off to all of the places that England colonized. And then they can display her body in their museums.
You know what the problem...
I think that would be very poetic.
The one problem with that is I think... I don't know if it's Catholics or Protestants who do this, so I'm so sorry. But I think that's how people honor saints, isn't it? They take bits of a saint.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, they like... Because if you go to Canterbury, there's like bits and bobs of saints just like in buildings, allegedly. I'm sure that it's not actually the bones of the saints, because people came in over the centuries and like, you know, stole... stuff, right? But depending on what kind of Christian Queen Elizabeth was and what kind of Christian does this, it might be honoring her to actually send bits and bobs of her all about the world. But
okay, that was not my intention, so thank you for clarifying.
No worries. I might be totally wrong though.
I think
want her to get her comeuppance. I want the colonized people of the world to have their say over what happens to the person who did that to them. But yeah, what are you going to say, Izzy?
Oh, I was just going to say, I think in the case for most Christians, like in terms of various artifacts and relics, It's not so much that they appreciate or think it's something good to break these people up into itty bitty pieces and set them around. It's more that in a lot of cases, the people that are being given sainthood, that's just how they died. And so there's just bits and bobs of them about, or at least that's how the story goes anyway. And then so you have everybody and their mom who finds a finger bone someplace saying it's a bit of Saint Paul or something.
Okay, so you're not saying the saints got blown to smithereens. You're saying, like, someone came with a body part and they were like, this is totally Saint Bob's finger.
Right, because, like, a lot of times, because what will happen for a lot of these saints is they'll, you know, a lot of them are, like, crucified, executed in some other ways, and in the process they'll be, like, you know, they'll be cut up to bits anyway, just in the process of getting killed. But even if that's not the case with them, people will still find like a finger and be like, oh, I got this from St. Paul's tomb or something like that. You know, just I keep saying St. Paul. I don't know why, but just whatever. Like, yeah, at least in any of the study that I ever did when I was being raised, I never came across it being specifically considered a holy thing to have parts of yourself sent into different places.
Listen, I'll trust your perspective, because like I say, I'm basing this off of knowing only that bits and bobs of saints are in places. Sure.
Well, I will say this. I think your point does stand in that if not now, 100 years from now, that's exactly what would happen with them. You know what I mean? There would still be like some monarchist floating around that'll be like, this is Queen Elizabeth's finger.
Yeah. Oh, poor Mason. We just were like, we took that tangent and then turned that into a whole segment.
Oh, no, that's chill. I'm leaving all of this in. It's good chill.
Okay.
Yeah. So, yeah, the Emperor of Japan had just died in 1989,
yes,
correct?
Yes, and this feels like a huge rupture, a huge historical rupture, I think. On top of that, the economy was bubbling, and it burst officially, I think, in 1991. It was around the same time the Soviet Union broke into a bunch of bits and bobs. And now I haven't, you know, I'm not an expert on Japanese history in the late 20th century or anything, but when I think about how I feel right now, when, you know, the economy is bubbling, or so many different parts of the world economy are bubbling, and a monarch has died, sometimes it feels like an explosion. It feels like society is resetting.
Yes.
I think that Akita is so cool because it metaphorizes the feeling of being somebody who's kind of downtrodden and who doesn't really have a lot of prospects, who is living through these huge historical shifts, how it can kind of feel like a big tectonic plate has just shifted beneath your feet, or like a volcano has gone off. Or an atom bomb is dropped on your head, to have some pretty to live through historically significant times, you know, to just watch history shift before your eyes. So I think that's what I think it's about. And then I think it's so exciting because it makes you think about what's left over, or what happens after the explosion goes off. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, there's that Lenin quote, there are weeks where decades happen.
Mm-hmm.
And I think lately we've been having a lot of weeks where decades happen, and like with every one of these ruptures, there is kind of like a violent rebirth. Like there's a new society in the place of the old, quite literally sometimes. However, that new society carries the collective traumas of the old society, even if they're trying to build a better one. Their history and what they do is still going to be informed by what came before it. Like, in my understanding, like after World War II, America basically went into Japan and reworked them to be a liberal democracy,
yep,
just like us. And this was something that was born out of a lot of unnecessary violence. Like, the dropping of the nuclear bombs on Japan was a fucking Holocaust, and it's easily as despicable and terrible as anything the Nazis were doing.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, like, it's, once again, it's this violent rebirth of society where we still carry the collective traumas of the past with us,
mm-hmm,
even though we're going forward into something new.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think one of the ways that's playing out right now is with the genocide in Palestine, because
yes,
so many of the conversations, yes, around what's happening to Palestinians are constantly rooted in history. And there's so many conversations about what's happening to Palestinians that are reflective of what happened to other people in other genocides throughout history, right? People draw parallels,
yes,
direct,
absolutely,
parallels between, you know, what happened to Jewish people during the Holocaust and what's happening to Palestinians now. And it's hard not to see, like, each event as just this sort of rehearsal of something that happened before, you know, or like a rehash of a previous traumatic event, a collective traumatic event. So.
Yeah. And that actually transitions very nicely into one of the final topics we were going to discuss, and that is the ongoing genocide in Palestine. Right now, there is a ceasefire. I mean, once this episode comes out, that'll be out of date, and Israel will probably have violated that ceasefire by then.
Well, and let's be clear, too, when we say there's a ceasefire.
It's only a four-day ceasefire.
Right, and it's not including anything,
yeah,
going on in the West Bank. Israel is still, like, doing horrible things in the West Bank area right now, and people in the West Bank are still getting displaced, hurt, and killed.
Yeah, absolutely. So a lot of people have been having conversations lately about this and kind of waking up to the reality of what the U.S. war machine does. And I swear to God, I'm not going to turn this into a podcast about Ukraine. But when the Russo-Ukrainian war broke out, like, it was a complicated issue which was simplified by the media and by our current administration as this thing where, like, the Ukrainians are fighting an anti-imperialist struggle. We have to support them. Never mind the fact that this whole time the Ukrainians are running up a tab on the weapons that we're sending to them. Never mind the fact that they're privatizing all of their infrastructure to pay for this war. But we were told that this is an anti-imperialist struggle, and that's basically all it was. Now we have in Palestine a genuine anti-imperialist, anti-colonial struggle. We have a resistance movement, which is very revolutionary, and an entrenched settler colonial power, which has the full backing of Europe, the United States, Canada. And we're being told that this situation is a lot more complicated than it actually is. However, something that has really been giving me a lot of hope lately is the fact that a lot of people are getting politically activated because of this. I was talking to a Palestinian friend who is active in protests and demonstrations and whatnot, and he said that one of the big phrases going around in the activist community right now is, we aren't liberating the Palestinians. The Palestinians are liberating us.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask you, since you had such a good video on this subject, what is the proper stance for those of us in North America to have on this genocide, and how can people get educated on this issue?
Well, so my instinct is to just say that, you know, the genocide is bad. But yeah. I think something that's maybe important for people to think about in North America is that it's not just an over there problem. Do you know what I mean? Like, yes. I think people hear something happening in a faraway place on the news, and it sounds very removed from their lives, and it's easy to detach themselves from the problems that people are facing. Protesters have said at pro-Palestine rallies for years, like, you know, in our thousands and our millions, we are all Palestinian, and this is a statement of solidarity. But I also think that it's an invitation to think about how our lives are connected to the Palestinian struggle, and also to how the Palestinian struggle manifests in our day-to-day lives in North America. Like, obviously, our elected officials are complicit in the genocide, because they either sign off on these things or they abstain from speaking out against, you know, sending arms over to Israel, or, you know, against even sanctioning Israel. Like, they won't engage in any actual meaningful action to stop the genocide from happening. But I think that what we've seen in the past 2 months is this stuff has a negative impact on people on the ground in North America. People who have been speaking out against the genocide have been losing their jobs. It's been tearing relationships apart. It's been, you know, like, so I have a friend who's doing her PhD, and she just got an email from her department head who was asking her if she had said something anti-Semitic on her private Instagram account, because somebody who followed her there had said, had noticed her posting, "From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free," and they went out of their way to email her department, and then the department chastised my friend and said, you know, they hope that she's not saying anything that would reflect badly on the department, which it's not a matter, like, that's just wild to me, because a PhD student is not a salaried employee. It doesn't matter what they say on their personal Instagram account. But then, you know, students have been getting kicked out of their programs for speaking out. Meanwhile, there is some really vile shit coming out of Zionist organizations. Zionists are still comfortable in their positions at these same institutions after saying vile shit, after justifying the genocide of Palestinians. And so it's just, I think that what it's showing me, at least, is that we are not safe from the problems that are affecting Palestinians. We are all affected by this on the ground level. And so I just think this is all just to say that we can't think about this as an over there issue. It's all a right here, right now problem. And
it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like just recently, the Senate in the United States passed a resolution not only condemning Hamas, but condemning college campuses which are allowing students to organize in support of Palestine.
Yeah.
And this is just the prelude to a lot of really repressive legislation, I believe. I think that over the next few years, as the ruling class gets more nervous, as they start seeing that the population is radicalizing and ready for a big change, they are going to start basically outlawing the support of certain things and organizing for certain purposes. And this whole time they're going to be working hand in hand with fascist groups, which are already about, and propping them up and suppressing any left movement which is organically forming around these issues.
So something that's interesting about that Senate amendment that I want to talk about real quick too, if you don't mind, Mason.
Oh, go ahead.
Thank you. It very specifically outlines what it is classifying as quote unquote pro-Hamas statements. And the statements that they outline in it are run the full range of literal pro-Hamas statements, but also just anything that is pro-Palestinian independence. And the amendment, or the resolution rather, passed unanimously. No one spoke out against it. So that should be genuinely terrifying, I think, to everyone in this country about where we're headed with this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think, like, there are certain things that, especially in the U.S., are supposed to be cornerstones to the democratic system functioning, like having access to your elected officials who are supposed to represent you, like being able to exercise your freedom of speech. And I think that the political class's reaction to people speaking out in favor of Palestinian sovereignty, even, I think that's exposing that most people don't have that basic thing that's supposed to be super important to sustaining the USA's democracy. If you can't, if elected officials are allowed to ignore your phone calls, how are you supposed to make sure that your voice is being heard, even, you know? So I just think, yeah, on top of the obviously frightening fascist overtones, it's like, I think it's exposing malfunctions, or I guess features rather than bugs, that have been in the system for a long time.
It's exposing that we've never really had any freedom of speech
if
we're like giving pushback. Like, we have a history in this country of putting sedition acts into law. I think the last time we did that was World War One, but they could come back. There is precedent for it. And like, I'll use an example from West Virginia. So in West Virginia, they have this governor named Jim Justice. He is basically a coal baron. He owns a bunch of fucking coal mines, and they're super unsafe, and he's making a killing off of them. But in West Virginia, they passed a law making it illegal to protest any like fossil fuel. I think they call it the like Critical Infrastructure Protection Act.
Wow.
And basically, like, if you protest against a coal field or oil drills or fracking or anything like that, you will get arrested and you will go to prison. And like on a state by state level, since the federal government has proven that they aren't going to really do anything to protect our rights, our rights are gradually being stripped away from us. And the positive thing about this is there are already networks and organizations of people who are organizing to get our rights back. But the scary part about it is they're not the ones who hold power. at least not right now.
Yeah, unfortunately, the people in this system that do hold power are either disinclined to do anything actively to resist what's coming, or are actively themselves participants.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But yeah, Palestine, it's an issue that is not actually that complicated, which has been overcomplicated by people who are pushing a specific narrative. And in my opinion, I think this opinion is reflected by my other two, by my host and my co-host and my guest here, is that what Israel is doing should be opposed tooth and nail, and we should keep showing up in the streets. We should keep marching. We should keep showing up at officials' houses. This is how we get shit done. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, literally. I mean, this can't stop until apartheid is over, is yeah. really what it boils yeah. down to. Like, we, now that we have a type of momentum going right now, the movement needs to keep moving. We can't afford to see what happened in 2020 with the uprisings happen here. The Palestinians, most of all, can't afford to see what happened to the 2020 uprisings happen here. And I think that... I think that activists in this country learned a great deal from what ended up happening with the 2020 uprisings and the directions things took, after certain elements basically co-opted the movement. And this situation doesn't really lend itself to that as easily. And in general, the messaging for this particular situation is particularly difficult for the U.S. government to control right now, especially after spending the last few years hammering away at this idea that we need to be protecting Ukraine from an imperialist adversary. It's hard to make that argument and then say, but the Palestinians are the bad guys.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It strikes anybody who's been paying attention as very hypocritical.
Yeah.
And it shows where our interests are. The United States wants to make as much money as they possibly can. They want to dominate as big of a chunk of the world as they possibly can. And Israel, as Nikki Haley said, is the tip of our spear.
Yeah.
In the Middle East.
Yeah. They're saying the quiet part out loud
yeah.
now.
Yeah, they are. I do think things are changing. Because, you know, I haven't obviously been around the block as long as some people have, but I think since I first started thinking about Palestine, I've even just in my own city, I've seen so many more people, you know, start to care. And I feel a huge difference even between 2021, the way the marches were then, and between now, because I think 2021 was when there was that press quarters in Gaza that Israel bombed. And there were protests mm-hmm. in my city, and right. the Zionists were out in full force, and there was way less attention on these rallies. But there's so much more support now, and I know that you know, optimism is generally a sort of trap, but I feel optimistic. I feel like most of the world is uniting on this issue. It does feel like the tides have sort of turned.
I have to say I agree with you. I think there's a lot of reason to be optimistic about what we're seeing right now. I want to specify what we're seeing right now in terms of how people are responding to what is happening. I do think there's a lot of reason to be optimistic. I've been active in politics for over 20 years now, and I don't think I can recall ever seeing anything unite so many different groups of people around the world on a single cause.
Mm-hmm.
And beyond that, I don't think I've ever seen a cause that was so strikingly, like, obvious which side is the moral one to be taking up with. And yet to see our governments react so with such contradiction to that, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that does. Yeah, I think that usually people are more divided on the issue, but it's hard to look at the images coming out of Palestine and feel anything but outrage.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a sickening situation. And the fact that we're having to do this just to like get our governments to take even the slightest measure to slow down what is happening. Yeah. Because that's really the best we can say about the ceasefire, right? It's barely a slowdown.
And the only reason the ceasefire is happening is because of like massive pressure from around the world.
Yeah. Including in Israel. I mean, there's lots of Israelis that are disgusted by what their government is doing. And so they're feeling pressure all across the board.
Yeah.
And in a way that they haven't in a very long time, if ever. I don't really think there's been this strong of an anti-Zionist movement, just in both among Jews and just in general since before the Holocaust.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So one last thing on this topic, and then we'll start wrapping up. What are some good resources aside from your wonderful video on the subject?
It is a wonderful
video.
Oh my gosh.
It is a good video. I enjoyed it. But what are some good resources for people to get educated on this subject? Like, what's a good place to start?
Well, I think if you Google resources, you're going to get a lot of history book recommendations, and those are great. But I started learning about Palestine through film. And I think that the advantage to that is it attaches faces, names, voices to the stuff that you are going to be reading in history books. And so I started learning. I'll recommend three documentaries, although I'll make a case for reading fictional stories too in a second. But there is a documentary called Arna's Children by a Palestinian and Israeli director. It's heartbreaking. It's hard to watch. But I think that it gives important perspective on why especially young Palestinians end up taking up arms against Israel. Another one that's getting promoted a lot right now is Five Broken Cameras. It's gorgeous. It's a guy documenting, you know, life under apartheid with like, and he sort of like breaks up the story he's telling based on which camera he was recording with at the time. And, you know, the cameras break. Another one I'll recommend, the last one, is Slingshot Hip Hop, which is, I think, another really useful glimpse into what it's like for people in Gaza and the West Bank to try to live out normal lives, to try to find joy with everything down to their movement being restricted under the occupation. And so yeah, I think that the main place that I would start is just with stories from Palestinians. Palestinians have been asking the world to listen to their stories since before the Nakba, and people won't even grant that basic courtesy. So the least that you can do, the best way to start learning, is to listen to Palestinian stories, even if they're fictional, because even these fictional stories, these fictional representations of life from Palestinians are acts of resistance. Like, they're things that Israel doesn't want to seep out into the world, you know? So start by taking in stories.
Another documentary I'd like to recommend too is the Al Jazeera documentary on the Nakba. It's a 4-part series. It is directed by a Palestinian woman, and I found it to be kind of a really solid one-stop shop to get a quick breakdown on, not quick, it's a 4-hour documentary, to get a breakdown on some of the history of what's been going on in Palestine since the late 1800s, really.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, I've also heard very good things about the documentary Gaza Fights for Freedom. Mm-hmm. I haven't watched it myself, but a lot of my friends have been watching it lately, and I've heard it's very good.
I should mention also, I linked this in the description of my video on Palestine, but Verso is offering a bunch of ebooks for free right now about Palestine. You can download, I think, 5 or 6 books, and they're famous ones, so go do that if you do want to read.
I will do that.
Yeah.
I love free books.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think that wraps up the Palestinian update for today. And we're gonna get a hangout soon. So before we go, is there anything that you'd like to plug?
Just my YouTube channel, Flundering Chipper, and my Patreon. I have a little podcast on there that's for patrons only right now, where I just do a longer form of what I do on my YouTube channel, which is talk about everything that is distracting me. So that's also, that is also called Flundering Chipper, that page. That's what I want to plug.
All right. Yeah. Very cool. Yeah. Thank you so much for coming on the show. This is really a dream come true for me because, like,
oh my gosh,
I've been watching you for so long and your videos are so good. And I was so happy when you said yes to, like, coming on.
No, thank you so much for having me. The best part about YouTube is getting to meet cool people and talk to people. So this is a dream come true for me to get to be here and have a nice time. So thank you so much. It was
really lovely having you here. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, it was great. Thanks. So yeah, that's the end of the episode, everybody. We'll see you guys in 2 weeks. Later.
Bye.
Bye.